From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, Ukraine approving joint military drills with NATO. Latest on efforts to revive the Middle East peace process. WHO says Ebola in Guinea is an outbreak, not an epidemic, plus the relationship between critical illness and mental illness. Steve Norman. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. NATO foreign ministers say they are suspending civilian and military cooperation with Russia because of the conflict over Ukraine. NATO Secretary General Anders Fogh Rasmussen made the announcement Tuesday at a special foreign ministers meeting in Brussels.
Through its actions, Russia has chosen to undermine the very foundations upon which our cooperation is built. The military action against Ukraine and the illegal annexation of part of Ukraine's sovereign territory constitute a flagrant breach of Russia's international commitments.
Mr. Rasmussen also spoke about NATO's continuing commitment to the interim government in Kiev.
Today we also agreed on further support to Ukraine. We will intensify our efforts to support Ukraine's defense reforms, to make the Ukrainian forces more professional and more effective. And we will provide advice on Ukraine's protection of critical infrastructure.
NATO chief also noted that the alliance agreed on working to make Ukraine's military forces, as we heard, more professional, more effective, and what he called a sign of collective solidarity.
We stand by our allies. We stand by Ukraine. And we stand by the international system of rules that we have made so much effort to build together over the last decades. And we urge Russia to engage in dialogue towards a political and diplomatic solution that respects international law and Ukraine's internationally recognized borders.
And while the NATO ministers met in Brussels, Ukraine decided it will host joint military exercises with European and NATO countries later this year. As part of the story from VOA's Daniel Scherf in Kiev.
Ukrainian lawmakers voted unanimously Tuesday to host joint military drills this year with European and North Atlantic Treaty Alliance defense forces. Ukraine's parliament, the Rada, voted 235-0 to allow the cooperative training, despite ongoing military tensions with Russia. The overwhelming support follows Russia's March annexation of the Black Sea Peninsula of Crimea and reports of a heavy Russian military buildup along Ukraine's border. Lieutenant General Mykhailo Koval is Ukraine's acting defense minister.
Передбачено допуск підрозділів інших держав для участі у восьми.
He says they granted permission to allow units from foreign countries, including those belonging to the European Union and NATO, to take part in 8 training exercises. He says the military personnel taking part in the drills will be about half Ukrainian and half foreign. The main thrust of the training is preparation for international peacekeeping operations, he says. They will also work on humanitarian, security, and search and rescue operations on land and water, as well as national defense. The joint exercises are expected to take place in Ukraine's Black Sea port of Odessa and could bring EU and NATO forces close to Russia's military in Crimea. Moscow views the NATO alliance as aimed at surrounding and isolating Russia. NATO's 28 member states, which now include former allies of the Soviet Union, agree to collective defense if one of them is attacked. Ukraine is not a NATO member, but hosted similar drills in the past. Since Russia's aggressive moves on Crimea, Kiev is considering upgrading its relations with the alliance, but has no plans to join it. Daniel Scherf, VOA News, Kiev.
Ukrainian lawmakers on Tuesday passed a bill to disarm all groups that have unlicensed weapons. Ukraine's acting president, Oleksandr Turchynov, spoke to parliament.
Український народ вимагає порядку. Ті, хто носить зброю,
said the Ukrainian people demand order. Those who have weapons, he said, can only belong to the armed forces of Ukraine, the National Guard or the Security Service of Ukraine, or other military groups. The declaration followed a shooting incident in central Kiev on Monday night involving a member of Right Sector, a Ukrainian nationalist group. Moscow has cited such groups like Right Sector in claiming that Nazis and fascists control Kiev streets and Ukraine's government. Kremlin used the alleged threat to ethnic Russians as a justification for seizing Crimea. Tensions mounted Tuesday after Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas declared his intent to press the United Nations for recognition over Israel's strong objections. As that was happening, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry, while in Brussels at the NATO Foreign Ministers meeting, spoke about his just-concluded trip to the Middle East and efforts to get the peace process back on track.
What is important to say about the Middle East right now is it is completely premature tonight to draw any kind of judgment, certainly any final judgment, about today's events and where things are. You know, this is a moment to be really clear-eyed and sober about this process. It is difficult. It is emotional. It requires huge decisions, some of them with great political difficulty, all of which need to come together simultaneously. And all I can tell you is that we are continuing, even now, as I am standing up here speaking, to be engaged with both parties to find the best way forward.
Mr. Kerry canceled his planned meeting with President Abbas scheduled for Thursday, but called on both sides to show restraint during this difficult period.
Obviously, it's moments like this when we all need to remember exactly what brought us to this effort in the first place, what the goal is, and where everybody wants to end up. And tonight, I haven't heard yet what the public response of Israel's been, but I know that President Abbas in his comments made it clear that he intends to continue to work, even tonight, on this process that we are engaged in.
Mr. Abbas's decision to go to the UN threw into doubt claims that the peace deal was emerging. There's speculation that it might also stop the U.S.-Israeli talks about releasing convicted spy Jonathan Pollard, an American Jew who passed thousands of classified documents to Israel while working for the U.S. Navy in the 1980s. Without specifically mentioning Pollard, Secretary Kerry spoke Tuesday about the prisoner release issue, which has been a stumbling block in the peace negotiations because Israel has not yet decided about further release of Palestinians who are detained by Israeli authorities.
At this point in time, no agreement has been reached with respect to any prisoner, not even the ones that at this moment are at issue in terms of the transfer. The cabinet in Israel has to vote. I'm not sure exactly when that might take place or not. And so there is no agreement at this point in time regarding anyone or any specific steps. There are a lot of different possibilities in play.
Releasing Pollard, which has been an issue in U.S.-Israeli relations for three decades, would be an extraordinary step underscoring the urgency of U.S. peace efforts.
News is mobile, and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
Yet another search for missing Malaysian Airlines Flight 370 will get underway today. On Tuesday, none of the ships or airplanes scouring the southern Indian Ocean saw anything. A Japanese Coast Guard jet was part of that search for any signs of the Boeing 777. Ahead of the Japanese Coast Guard search effort, Kojiro Tanaka said bad weather made the search difficult. In total, 10 planes, including the Japanese Coast Guard jet, searched for the missing airliner on Tuesday. They were joined by 11 ships. Meantime, in Beijing, relatives of missing Chinese passengers prayed for their loved ones ahead of a regular briefing with Malaysian officials. This woman identified as Mrs. Han spoke to reporters. She is the mother of one of the passengers on Flight 370. She said, "We are waiting for our relatives to come home." She also said, "There is absolutely nothing else we can do." Chinese relatives have been angry with Malaysian officials due to what they see as a lack of information and the ongoing search efforts. Malaysian Airlines Flight 370 went missing about an hour after taking off from Kuala Lumpur on March 8th for Beijing. The search has been concentrated for many days now, about 1,800 kilometers off the west coast of Australia. Also in the news, the South Korean news agency Yonhap is reporting an unmanned drone crashed on a South Korean island in the Yellow Sea. The crash occurred earlier this week during a three-hour artillery and rocket exchange between the two Koreas along their disputed maritime border. Agency says the South Korean military is looking into any possible link to North Korea's espionage activities. Meantime, South Korea is defending its firing of hundreds of shells into North Korean waters on Monday in retaliation for an estimated 100 of some 500 shells fired by the North, which fell on the South Korean side of their western maritime border as a sufficient response. Defense Ministry spokesman said the response is designed to ensure that Pyongyang will be left unwilling to make another attack. In a conversation with VOA's Victor Beatty, Tufts University Korean Studies Assistant Professor Sunyoung Lee cautions that this is a calculated tactic by North Korea that can almost be predicted by the calendar.
Springtime is North Korea's favorite time of provocations because by doing things early in the calendar year, by raising the stakes, by reminding its chief adversaries that they have to deal with North Korea and not go on ignoring it, which means by becoming a political burden for Washington and Seoul, North Korea sees that its prospects for receiving ever bigger and newer concessions, blandishments, improve. And over the past 20 years, although that kind of tactic may not always have worked, I would say in the main, it's been a very effective policy for North Korea, leading to literally billions of dollars in virtually unconditional aid from South Korea, clearly over $10 billion during the so-called Sunshine Policy years from 1998 to 2008. And even from the United States, virtually unconditional aid in excess of $1.3 billion from 1998 to 2005, meaning both the Clinton administration and the Bush administration. In 1998, North Korea raised the stakes by firing a missile over Japan. It was North Korea's first long-range missile test. And although the test was a failure, that led to a flurry of diplomatic activity. And the United States, the next year, for the empty privilege of inspecting an empty North Korean cave, which the U.S. suspected of housing nuclear or military hardware, the U.S. gave North Korea $177 million of food aid, and that set a very unfortunate precedent under which North Korea provokes, the U.S. returns to negotiations with bigger blandishments in tow.
So you're telling me that the international community has not learned from the past?
I don't think so. I think the international community has really conditioned North Korea to resort to these, you know, cycles of provocations. The only time that there was any kind of real credible threat was when the Bush administration pursued a policy of financial sanctions against North Korea, against North Korean-held accounts at a small Macanese bank from September 2005 until the next year, until October 2006, when North Korea conducted its first nuclear test, again raising the stakes, and thereafter the Bush administration did a complete turnaround, made all kinds of accessions, going back to negotiations, resuming food aid, lifting the highly effective financial sanctions, and even taking North Korea off the state sponsors of terrorism list. In the twilight years of the Bush administration, Bush left office in early 2009 with nothing to show for it. No North Korea legacy whatsoever.
Professor Lee says the North's real vulnerability remains what he called its illicit streams of revenue that allow the political elite there to maintain a luxurious lifestyle. They also told VOA, given the North's warning Sunday of a new nuclear test, it would be in character for the North to conduct such a test early in the year, similar to the long-range missile test and the second nuclear test conducted during April and May of 2009, when President Obama was busy with the U.S. recession and extricating U.S. forces from Iraq and Afghanistan.
VOA Special English, a way to learn American English and much more. Broadcasting a half hour of world news and features every day on radio. You can also find Special English on television and online at voaspecialenglish.com. For 50 years, helping people understand world events and the language and culture of America.
Multiple explosions near an oil depot in the Nigerian city of Maiduguri have killed at least 15 civilians, as well as six suicide bombers. Police commissioner of Nigeria's Borno State said the attack appeared to be the work of Islamist militant group Boko Haram, group blamed for thousands of deaths since 2009. Police in Kenya's capital have arrested more than 650 people following explosions that killed at least six people on Monday. Kenyan newspapers say police carried out nighttime raids in the Eastleigh section of Nairobi, where the blast struck two restaurants and a woman's health clinic. Member of Parliament for the area, Yusuf Hassan Abdi, tells VOA he wants police to conduct a thorough security operation while not committing abuses.
We have to call upon the government to protect the innocent, to protect the human rights of the people of the constituency, and not to punish the people of Eastleigh collectively, to profile the population and to carry out a fishing expedition. That we would not want to see.
In a statement on Tuesday, Kenya's Interior Cabinet Secretary Joseph Lenku called the bombings barbaric and said the security operation will continue until those responsible for the bombings are caught. No one's claimed responsibility for the attacks, which also wounded at least 25 people. World Health Organization says the Ebola outbreak in Guinea is very serious, but has not reached epidemic proportions. The latest WHO figures show 80 people have died among the 122 suspected cases of Ebola in Guinea. Lisa Schlein reporting now from WHO headquarters in Geneva.
The World Health Organization is trying to calm a sense of panic in some areas about the seriousness of the Ebola outbreak in the West African country of Guinea. It rejects claims by the medical aid group Doctors Without Borders that the outbreak of the disease is unprecedented. WHO spokesman Gregory Hartle says there have been larger outbreaks of Ebola recorded in Uganda and the Democratic Republic of Congo. He says the outbreak in Guinea is relatively small compared to the one in Uganda in 2000 and 2001, which infected more than 400 people. Four cases of the disease have been reported in the Guinean capital Conakry, but Hartle says it is not unusual to have cases in capital cities.
In Gabon in the 1990s, I believe there were cases in Libreville. The same idea where someone basically was infected elsewhere and got him or herself to Libreville because of basically medical facilities being better in the capital than elsewhere. The source of infection is still quite localized in the southeast of Guinea. So for us, this fits the pattern of all previous Ebola outbreaks.
The World Health Organization says the disease has not spread to other countries. It says the seven suspected cases of Ebola, including four deaths in neighboring Liberia, occurred among Liberians who traveled to Guinea and were infected there. It notes laboratory tests of several suspected cases in Sierra Leone have all come back negative. Ebola is spread through blood and other bodily fluids from an infected person. It can also be transmitted by the handling of contaminated corpses. Bats and primates are the original source of the infection. Hartle says it is essential to stop the chains of transmission.
It's a question of controlling infection in hospitals. It's a question of controlling transmission among the people who might have been infected and don't know that they have been infected yet or are not in hospitals. Hence, as always, the two most important things are what we do in hospitals and how we trace contacts.
Authorities in Senegal have closed the land border with Guinea to prevent the spread of Ebola into their country. Hartle tells VOA the WHO does not recommend travel restrictions, which he says do not make sense. The incubation period for Ebola can be as long as 21 days. The World Health Organization says the outbreak cannot be considered until two incubation periods of 42 days have passed without a single transmission of the virus. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
A new report shows people with critical illnesses are more likely to develop post-traumatic stress disorder and other psychiatric illnesses than people who haven't experienced a life-threatening disease. VOA's Carol Pearson has our report.
Studies show a connection between diabetes and heart disease and depression. It's been documented. But what about people who experience life-threatening illnesses? Dr. Derek Angus of the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center decided to see if a critical physical illness caused a mental illness. He and a team of researchers looked through the medical records of all patients admitted to intensive care units in Denmark over a 3-year period.
Denmark is important because for many years now, they've been collecting national data on essentially the health and wellness of every person living in Denmark. We were interested in people who got a new or sudden critical illness, such as a pneumonia or an episode of sepsis.
For example, patients on ventilators admitted to the intensive care unit, or ICU, were compared to similar patients in other wards of the hospital and in the general population.
Patients who came into the ICU were in fact more likely to already have pre-existing psychiatric illness or to already be on psychiatric medications.
But the researchers were curious about the follow-up data for ICU patients who had no previous mental illnesses and had not been on psychiatric medications.
There was an absolute new risk of new psychiatric diagnoses and new psychoactive medication use. Even though it was less than 1%, it was 20-fold higher than the likelihood of getting a new psychiatric illness had you been a general population member with similar underlying characteristics.
The risk of needing psychiatric medications was high enough that Dr. Angus says doctors should tell patients and their families that depression, anxiety, or post-traumatic stress disorder is a known complication of surviving critical illness. The study found the risk was highest in the first 3 months after being discharged and declined as time went on. The study was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association. Carol Pearson, VOA News.
World's top-ranked golfer, American Tiger Woods, has withdrawn from the sport's first major championship of the year after undergoing back surgery. 38-year-old Woods said Tuesday he's dropped out of next week's Masters tournament in the southern U.S. city of Augusta, Georgia. He said he underwent a successful operation on Monday to correct a pinched nerve that had been bothering him for several months, but now faces several weeks of rest and rehabilitation. Woods has won 14 major golf championships and has been pursuing the record of 18 held by retired U.S. golfer Jack Nicklaus. Woods has won several tournaments in the past couple of years, but has not captured a major championship since the U.S. Open in 2008. He's played in every Masters tournament since 1995 when he was an amateur, but with this year's withdrawal from the Masters, he will have missed all four of the world's top championships at one time or another because of injury. Many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. Good to have you with us today. You know, you can always find us on the Internet anytime at voanews.com. Hope you'll stay with us. The latest world news is coming up shortly. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Zubair Al-Tayeb, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Wednesday.
This is Today in History. On April 2nd, 1865, Confederate President Jefferson Davis and most of his cabinet fled the rebel capital, Richmond, Virginia, not long after Confederate troops surrendered, ending the American Civil War. In 1982, Argentina invaded Britain's Falkland Islands, located in the South Atlantic Ocean. Following a two-month war, Argentina surrendered to the British and withdrew from the Falklands. Danish author and poet Hans Christian Andersen was born on this day in 1805. Andersen was most famous for his cherished fairy tales. In 1917, U.S. President Woodrow Wilson asked the U.S. Congress for a declaration of war against Germany and an entrance into World War I. 4 days later, Congress obliged. On this day in 1942, Glenn Miller and his orchestra recorded one of his most requested hits. It's called American Patrol. Dominated the American music scene just as the United States was entering World War II. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The recently concluded Nuclear Security Summit in The Hague has helped reduce the threat of nuclear proliferation and terrorism by helping to secure nuclear sites and eliminating vast supplies of highly enriched uranium. In particular, Belgium and Italy have completely removed their excess supplies of highly enriched uranium and plutonium. In a major commitment, Japan announced that it will work with the United States to eliminate hundreds of kilograms of weapons-usable material from one of their experimental reactors, which would be enough for a dozen nuclear weapons. Dozens of other nations have taken specific steps towards improving nuclear security in their own countries and to support global efforts. The United States and Kazakhstan expressed a shared commitment to nonproliferation and nuclear security. Both countries agreed to continue to strengthen the physical security on the former Semipalatinsk test site. The United States will also continue to help Kazakhstan prevent illicit trafficking in nuclear and radiological materials. Both countries will continue to work together to convert Kazakhstan's remaining highly enriched uranium reactors to low-enriched uranium fuel and eliminate all remaining highly enriched uranium research reactor fuel as soon as technically feasible. The Nuclear Security Summit, said President Obama, has not just been talk, it's been action. Since the first summit was held in 2010, 12 countries and two dozen nuclear facilities around the world have rid themselves entirely of highly enriched uranium and plutonium. Dozens of nations have boosted security at their nuclear storage sites, built their own counter-smuggling teams, or created new centers to improve nuclear security and training. The International Atomic Energy Agency is stronger. More countries have ratified the treaties and international partnerships at the heart of our efforts. The next summit will be held in the United States in 2016. It is time to accelerate our efforts over the next 2 years, said President Obama, so that the threat of nuclear proliferation and terrorism become a thing of the past.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.